is a plug-in hybrid. And these vehicles have both an electric and an internal combustion engine, but they can be charged through plugging in. So that's just an important distinction in terminology so that you have an understanding of what's coming down the road. Another point of distinction I want to make. Most battery electric vehicles will be coming to market, that are coming to market, are going to have a range of about 100 miles, 80 to 100 miles. Some more expensive models, such as a Tesla, have a range of over 200 miles. Since the range is substantially below what a typical gas car delivers, there is some concern that consumers may have for range anxiety. There may be a concern that they're not going to be able to power up their car to get to their destination. Even though the bulk of drivers travel substantially less than the 100-mile range of these vehicles in a typical day. To address this type of concern and smooth the transition to EVs, it's going to be necessary to provide a sufficient public charging network to assuage that range anxiety. And I'll get into a little bit about what the EV charging infrastructure is. So in order to accommodate the vehicles and charge the car's batteries, the charging stations will be located primarily in people's homes where they would charge overnight. But there's also it's key to have locations in publicly accessible locations such as retail facilities, public facilities, and to some extent in the right of way. The new wave of charging stations, or as it's more technically called, electric vehicle service equipment, are 240-volt stations and operate on a circuit comparable to a clothes dryer plug, and they're more commonly called a level 2 charging. That's what we're going to be seeing deployed for the most part within the coming year. To charge a typical electric vehicle from zero to full on this level 2 charging will take approximately 4 to 8 hours and can generally be accomplished overnight. There are also other types of charging known as fast charging that can charge a typical car's battery in less than 30 minutes. And that's a DC fast charge. The current opportunity that we're facing is because of proactive early adopters and the highest per capita adoption of hybrid technology, Portland has been a recognized leader in the field of electric vehicles. Even the limited current charging station network that's in place now, it's about 24 charging stations currently in the region, serves as a beacon to the electric vehicle industry. What Portland and Oregon have received a huge boost within the last year with the announcement of a $100 million U.S. Department of Energy grant to install electric vehicle charging infrastructure in 5 key launch markets. That's actually been expanding over the past few months as well. As part of this program, which is called the EV Project, and it's administered by Ecotality North America, the Willamette Valley will receive approximately 2,000 charging stations for home and public use. The grant is tied to 900 Nissan Leaf cars that will participate in what amounts to a large study. The EV Project is currently planning the locations for the charging stations and will be starting to place units in the ground this fall. The city is working with Ecotality to ensure that the units are deployed appropriately.
How much did you say we get of that? Of the 100 million?
Well, the 100 million was the original grant of 100 million was supplied throughout the country in 5 key markets, Oregon being one of them. If you break it out by 5, it would be about 20 million within Oregon. So it's within 4 key cities in Oregon.
Terrific. Thank you.
The EV project will give Portland a great boost in creating the necessary infrastructure to support EV usage. Often with electric vehicles, there's a chicken and egg problem, but the city will have a leg up in this area when compared to other cities and regions. Portland has already seen a significant investment from EV manufacturers as a launch market and an early testing market. Witness the recent launch of the Navistar E-Star truck a month ago at the convention center, and a constant parade of future EVs coming through the city. In addition to the EV project, there are a number of federal and state incentives that aid in EV adoption. When taken together with federal incentives for electric vehicles, Oregon is one of the leaders in tax credits for electric vehicles. Currently, there's a federal tax credit of approximately $7,500 for a typical EV and an additional $1,500 available as a state credit. This helps to take out a bite of the significant higher upfront cost of some electric vehicles. Recognizing that EVs have the potential for significantly altering our driving usage and environmental impacts, the EV working group is looking to a more sustainable approach to incorporating EVs into our transportation system in Portland. This morning you will hear about the various programs around EVs from a number of city bureaus. And now I'm going to hand to Michael Armstrong from the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability. And then after him will be Dan Bauer from Transportation and John Hunt from City Fleet.
Great. Thanks a lot, James. I'm Michael Armstrong with the City's Bureau of Planning and Sustainability. I want to talk for just a moment here about the environmental impacts of electric vehicles and the potential that they offer to us. I think you're all aware that the City of Portland has worked on climate change for more than 15 years now. And we have an encouraging story to tell about carbon emissions. The chart here in front of you shows the trend in carbon emissions locally here in Multnomah County, as well as nationally. It's going back to 1990, and what you can see is a pretty wide gap opening with the local emissions, the lower orange bar, and the national emissions, the blue bar. As of 2008, emissions locally were about 1% below 1990 levels. That compares to an increase of about 13% nationally. Preliminary numbers for last year suggest we've seen a slight drop again. So that's a very encouraging trend. It's a real departure, and it's happened over a time when we've had strong population growth and, for the most part, a strong economy, though not for the last couple of years. This is encouraging. It's also a cautionary tale. We've got emissions down to about 1990 levels. What we know from the international scientists is that to stabilize the climate and avoid the most serious disruptions, we need to reduce carbon emissions by something like 80% from current levels. So if you look at the same data showing where we are today, put our goal of an 80% reduction by 2050 on the chart, it's clear that the work we've done to date, while encouraging, isn't going to get us there. This is the conversation that led to your adopting last year a climate action plan that is intended to put us on a path to reduce carbon emissions 80% below current levels by 2050. And electric vehicles are an important piece of that puzzle. The climate action plan includes a couple of actions that are related to electric vehicles. One of them is to reduce the greenhouse gas impacts on a life cycle basis of transportation fuels 20%. The second is much more specific to the opportunity that electric fuels vehicles present to us. I want to be very clear here that electric vehicles are an important piece of the solution, but they are no substitute for complete neighborhoods where you're able to walk to the things you need. They're no substitute for trips you take by walking, by bicycle, by transit, but they're a fantastic substitute for trips that are really only practical in a car. So we do want electric vehicles to be a convenient, affordable, easy choice for people when they do need to take a trip by car. On a life cycle basis, and so looking at the production of the vehicle, generating the electricity to power the car, we see very significant benefits from electric vehicles. At least 25%, some studies suggest it's much higher than that. This is a big bite. If you put that...
Excuse me, what was that 25% again?
So that it's the reduction in life cycle greenhouse gas emissions associated with vehicles and the fuel use, so on a life cycle basis. There are a number of studies out there. They typically find benefits well above that. I want to just contrast that with our goal of reducing emissions by 80%. So if we only succeed in shifting all of our vehicle trips to electric vehicles, we don't come close. So we need to make sure that we're doing what we need to do in terms of the shape of our community, in terms of giving people options. There are always going to be trips that we need to make by cars, and electric vehicles are a really great choice for that. I want to also be clear that there are big other environmental benefits, and the community health benefits from electric vehicles are very significant as well. Our tailpipe emissions from vehicles are a very serious contributor to local respiratory health. Electric vehicles have no tailpipe emissions. We can absolutely eliminate emissions of carbon monoxide, of volatile organic compounds from our cars. That's a big opportunity that delivers a lot of community benefits that make a real difference to people on the streets, walking, biking, everybody who's out in the community. So there are significant carbon opportunities with electric vehicles. There are very significant community health benefits as well. In developing the Climate Action Plan, we looked at a couple different scenarios for ways we could meet that goal. The one we settled on as a plausible scenario includes traveling about 13% of all the vehicle miles traveled in Multnomah County by 2030 in electric vehicles. And so that number could be very low. It could be very high. But just to give you a scale of the spread of electric vehicles that we think could be part of the solution, that means 50,000 electric vehicles. So we'll see how the market responds to this new introduction, but we really do want to give people in Portland the chance to use electric vehicles, and that's what this roadmap is about. So we've really appreciated the process that this has gone through. Look forward to continuing to work on the implementation. So I think next up is Dan Bauer with the Bureau of Transportation.
Thanks, Michael. Good morning. My name is Dan Bauer with Policy Program Manager with Transportation Options here at the City. And I'm going to provide a quick snapshot of some of the highlights of the EV strategy that's in front of you here today. First, just building on what Michael said, I want to reiterate that the Bureau of Transportation is committed to achieving its targets adopted in the Climate Action Plan. Right now, we're in the process of looking at several carbon reduction strategies, and electric vehicles are part of that strategy, and we're excited about what they can do for us right now. The Bureau is also committed to its existing policy framework of providing quality transportation choices for residents and businesses. We look forward to including the EVs in the mix of transportation options here in Portland. Now, when it comes to pursuing leadership in the field of electric vehicles, the temptation is to look for the big idea, the one thing that nobody had thought of that would put Portland on the map. In the case of EVs, however, leadership comes in the form of rather boring but extremely important details that make it easy for residents and businesses to transition to electric vehicles. These details include a range of items, including consumer education and permitting, and partnerships that benefit the public. The intent of this strategy is to demonstrate how a city government can play a role in expanding access to new technology. Individually, the steps the city has taken may seem minor to some. However, collectively, the strategy demonstrates a holistic approach and attention to detail that will prove to be a national model. For example, most EV users will need to have a home charging unit installed in their house. An EV charging unit installed in their home. This installation of these charging stations requires a permit from the Bureau of Development Services. Following the state's lead, the city is now including EV charging station installations in its minor label program, meaning electricians are free to install electric charging stations in people's homes with little or no wait time for permits. This model has proven successful with furnaces and water heaters as well. However, in some cases, users will need to get permits outside this program. That's why BDS has streamlined the permitting process for electric vehicle installation. And the city will soon launch a website, a one-stop website, where users can learn about EV permitting, apply for a permit, and receive inspection within 48 hours. Similarly, the Bureau of Transportation recognizes that while most charging will occur off-street, there are instances where we're going to need to provide charging in the right-of-way. Or there might be a unique opportunity to provide charging station in the right-of-way along with public art, Wi-Fi, or renewable power generation. Recognizing this need, the Bureau has developed a first-of-its-kind policy that allows for a limited number of charging stations to be placed in the right-of-way. The policy right now is a strap that would allow for 50 charging stations to be placed in the public right-of-way in the city. Allowing this charging presents a series of other issues, including parking management, public safety, and franchise management. The charging in the right-of-way policy tries to address each of these issues in turn and makes it simple and transparent for the business community who's interested in placing these stations in the right-of-way. Another issue is that of garage-free homes. With EV infrastructure built primarily around charging in the home at night, the lack of garage or off-street parking presents a major barrier for Portland residents who want to engage in the EV market. We're taking a leading role in solving this challenge by creating partnerships that broaden access to EVs so all residents can benefit from the technology. Most notably, we're exploring a partnership with Zipcar, wherein users who do not have off-street parking can charge at a city-owned garage or lot and use Zipcar's reservation technology to secure a time and location that works best for them. This partnership provides fast and reliable charging for residents that do not have the ability to charge at home. Along these same lines, we're working with TriMet and others to explore how EV charging can complement underutilized parking or parking that would otherwise sit empty at night. We're also exploring how EV infrastructure can be built into park and ride facilities in the city of Portland. These are just some examples. And the strategies represent educated first steps into the EV world. Just like James was saying, I think the city needs to remain flexible and continue to monitor best practices in this field. I'll be available for questions later, but I'm going to pass it on to John Hunt here to talk about some of the fleet specifics.
Could you move over so he can get closer? Thank you very much.
Good morning, John Hunt, City Fleet Manager. And I guess I'd just like to give folks an update on where we are within the city of Portland's fleet. We basically did a comprehensive analysis of the entire fleet, breaking down vehicles by class, and then looking at different homes that new technologies would best fit. In fact, you may or may not know this, but way back early on, we looked at things like electric forklifts and electric utility vehicles for parks and electric sand rakes. And we actually have about 40 pieces of equipment out there now that work very well. Think of a forklift inside of an enclosed building and how the clean air benefits can immediately benefit the person that's using it and the coworkers around them. But until recent times, there really hasn't been a lot out there on the market in the way of a sedan. And we're, I think, quite fortunate that Nissan now has a car available. As mentioned earlier, Chevrolet Volt is the extended range car. There's also quite a bit out there in the way of medium duty vehicles that are now coming with electric technology on board. We added a couple of electric bicycles to our motor pool, and those are working out real well. And I think I just wanted everybody to know that we are analyzing the city's fleet, trying to figure out the best solutions, working with the bureaus to analyze what their need truly is, what's the best fit for the application. And then we look at how best to obtain the technology. So I think that's kind of where we are. And again, we're excited that to be a part of the industry.
I have a question, John.
Yeah.
So, John, on the subject of the Chevrolet Volt, that's scheduled to come out this fall, is that correct?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And so have we done a specific analysis of that vehicle, looked at the write-ups that have been available so far to see, because it appears to me that that matches up best with what the wide-ranging needs we may have of the commercially available electric vehicles, including Nissan.
I agree with you. And, Commissioner, everything that we've seen so far, it looks like a very positive way to go because you're running on really electricity, but you have the extended range, and then the cost benefits are there because of low fuel usage. You get a lot better brake wear because these cars are using regenerative braking systems, and so we're really moving into a very efficient travel.
I guess my question is, have we taken the next step? So I'm glad that you agree that that looks like the most promising electric vehicle out there. Have we taken the next step and actually contacted GM to inquire about fleet prices, those kinds of things for the Chevrolet Volt?
We've actually contacted all the suppliers on fleet, and they're actually, interestingly enough, not ready to do fleets because of the scarcity of initial production. But we've gotten our foot in, we've gotten our on the waiting list for about four manufacturers, including GM.
Are there, that's correct. Of the four manufacturers, how many are American manufactured?
Well, definitely GM and Ford, and we haven't been successful yet with Chrysler, but we're working on it.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And then we've Mitsubishi and Nissan, and then Navistar. We work closely with Navistar, and their delivery truck, I mean, their FedEx kind of truck, our utility trucks that they introduced here in Portland about a month and a half ago. We're in discussions with them on fleet leasing or purchasing of those, because those are very much what our bureaus use every day.
That's great. So you're aggressively...
They're made in the U.S.
Yes, and we might say, add this in too, that we, along with other cities along this corridor, the West Coast is really a hot place for this new technology, and we're working with Seattle and ourselves and others. And just to be really honest with you, the big stumbling part is the technology with the batteries, because they're expensive. But they're also looking at like secondary markets to use the batteries for storage capacity, and that might lower the overall cost of the vehicle significantly, but it's a little bit too early to really say exactly what that'll do for the lowering of the overall cost of the vehicle. But I just wanted you to know that we're actively working with the industry every day to figure out how to best proceed.
Although I just read that Chevrolet is going to warrant the Volt for 8 years, 100,000 miles.
That is correct.
The battery specifically.
Yeah.
So following up on Commissioner Leonard's question, when the report talks about buying 10 Leafs this year, has that been decided, or are you still looking at the different vehicles?
Right now, we're in the process of looking at them, but in order to bring vehicles to the market, the manufacturer just asked, more as a straw man type letter, how many would you have homes for? And so Multnomah County identified 4 homes, and we identified 6 homes, but we have not, you know, entered into the purchasing agreement yet.
And that purchasing agreement would come back to council, and at that point you'd have all of the numbers about costs and benefits and such. And
that's right. Especially with this new technology, we'll ensure that you know about each PCS.
Great, thank you.
What do you mean by a home when you say 4 homes, 6 homes?
Just a place to put the vehicle, the bureau. You know, so in other words, if a bureau has a need for that specific vehicle, then we call it a home for it. Yeah.
So I have a question, and this is obviously a question about electric vehicles and nothing to do with what we're doing here, which I think is great. But I'm curious, do the electric vehicles, I mean, to me, the beauty of hybrid is you capture waste heat, friction, and you use it to travel on. Do the electric vehicles plan to do that also to make?
Yeah, I mean, they have the same type of regenerative braking in them that feeds back into the battery. So it's almost the identical technology that's in the hybrids. Okay. So it is regenerating all that braking energy back into the to charge the battery.
Okay.
Great. In the case of the Volt, it has a very small engine. It's only used to kick on.
So
the battery gets down far enough to recharge the battery. So it's really very versatile.
Yeah, that's the Volt is a bit of an interesting case. Unlike a normal hybrid, it runs purely on electric, and then it is a generator that feeds that battery to run the vehicle. So for the first,
if you're using petroleum, it's the most efficient way to use it in
Excuse me.
Yeah, just kind of a quick, kind of an interesting thing I recently learned is that if you drive a short distance, you'll use only the battery. But let's say that you're always driving a short distance. Well, it's conceivable that the engine wouldn't start, but they've programmed into the car that after so many, you know, hours, let's say, then the engine will actually start so that it cleans the fuel out to keep the fuel fresh. So I thought that was an interesting point.
It's a fascinating technology.
Very much so.
Any additional council discussion?
So at a right-of-way charging station, it would take 30 minutes to recharge?
Yeah, and I want to actually just wrap up the rest, and then maybe we can get to those. But yes, so there's different types of charging. Like we said, there's the level 2, and then there's the fast charge. So the fast charge would be about a 30-minute charge from basically 0 to it's actually 80% of the capacity of the battery.
Do you get a benefit if you do it for 15 minutes?
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it doesn't have to be the full amount. I mean, if you only need a 10-minute charge, you can get that to get you where you want to be in terms of the charge level.
But you're not locked in. It doesn't lock.
No, exactly. Yeah. I mean, it does engage, but you can say, I'm done with my charge and pull it off. So yeah, you don't have to sit there the whole time. So most charging that's going to be at home is this level 2 type charging, which takes 4 to 8 hours to fully charge the battery. So those type of charging units will be at home and in public locations. So people can top off their batteries. Even if they're parked for 20 minutes, they can top off their battery even slightly to get some charge on the level 2, but if you're traveling a longer distance, you would need to sort of hopscotch between these fast charging. So you'd pull into fast charge, get the 30-minute charge, and keep go on your way along a corridor. So, John, did you have any more? Okay. So just to wrap up, thank you, John, and so you've heard a number of initiatives in different areas, and I wanted to wrap up with some of the initiatives of the Portland Development Commission that we've been working on economic development and job creation. In support of the city's economic development strategy to make Portland the capital of the global green economy and the most sustainable economy in the world, PDC is undertaking initiatives to smooth the way for EVs and fuel demand for this new industry. We hope to foster demand for local products and services, including vehicles, components, charging stations, batteries, and other related services, all of which have local representation in those fields. One method that PDC has pursued is target industry development. PDC identified an emerging cluster of EV-related businesses in Portland and Oregon in 2009, and PDC has been working with Business Oregon to help support these businesses grow the cluster and in turn create jobs. As of early summer 2010, Oregon already has well over 40 companies actively working on transportation electrification and vehicle efficiency technologies. The industry group that is forming, Drive Oregon, is positioning itself to partner with research institutions and utilities to become a vessel for state and federal funding to propel the industry and attract other external financial resources. Along with assisting the development of homegrown businesses, there are significant opportunities for partnering with external firms and automakers that can be prove beneficial for growth of the local industry, as well as provide opportunities to showcase Portland on a national and international scale. Witness the recent MOU with General Electric as an example of an opportunity that we can use to really showcase Portland's leadership in the green economy. On the regional front, the city is actively seeking to partner with local utilities, other public agencies, jurisdictions, and universities on pilot projects and other opportunities to showcase and highlight EVs and how they fit in Portland. Public awareness is key. Public awareness is key to the success of EVs, and as you've heard, the success of EVs is essential to improving our local environment and meeting the goals of the Climate Action Plan, as well as assisting with economic development goals. As you heard from Dan, providing a clear path for permitting is also essential to enable deployment of the appropriate charging infrastructure. And lastly, decisions made by individual bureaus can help ensure that the fleet can be a leader in EV adoption. The key point there is that decision-making on fleet vehicles is actually driven to the most part by the actual bureaus. So by staking a claim and wanting to be a leader in adoption, it's key for each bureau to work closely with the fleet folks to make that happen. We look forward to working with you and your bureaus to help keep Portland a leader in EVs and a role model for other cities around the country and the world. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any additional council discussion? You've done a fantastic job, and I want to thank each of you and the teams behind you, along with Katya Dillman, and our partnership with PSU and PGE and a host of other public and private nonprofit organizations. Thank you. Anyone else signed up to testify?
No one else signed up.
Okay. Can you please call the vote?
Saltzman?
Well, this is outstanding work, and it's very exciting work, and so I do hope that we are successful and this country is successful in wider adoption of electric vehicles or hybrid electrics. I truly think they have not only carbon emission benefits, but air quality benefits too, which are integrally related to one another, but they are quite different. But as anybody who's been stuck in traffic or worked in a warehouse with a diesel forklift or something like that can appreciate, an electric vehicle is a much safer, cleaner option. I look forward to all the excitement that's around this, and I want to thank the mayor for his leadership on this, and I think we're going to see some real tangible results and jobs to go with it. Aye.
Leonard.
Aye.
Fritz.
Well, thank you, especially to Katya Dillman, who late last night and early this morning was still answering questions from me in my office, and I certainly appreciate that. The mayor persuaded me to upgrade my cell phone a month or so ago, and so I relate to the range anxiety issue because it runs out of charge a lot quicker than the old ancient phone used to. So the government's job is to provide infrastructure for things like this, and certainly charging stations in the right-of-way should probably be done by government. So I'm interested in that aspect. I'm relieved to hear that individual strategies such as buying fleet vehicles would come back for full discussion before council. I was a little concerned about the title of the resolution, but with that understood that we're not actually authorizing massive purchases at this point. We're authorizing a strategy and to move forward, and I appreciate the mayor's leadership on this issue. Aye.
Fish.
Thank you for an excellent presentation, and Mayor, congratulations for your leadership on this. Aye.
Adams.
Thank you. Portland, it is within Portland's grasp to become the electric vehicle hub for North America. And our equal distance between Europe and Asia. We'll be traveling to Detroit soon to follow up on our conversations with the U.S. manufacturers. the fact we've already implemented or released Navistar's electric utility vehicle here in Portland. This strategy today will promote us as a hub for electric vehicles. So I want to thank the council for their support. And again, I want to thank all the great staff work, Katja, for my team, for your great work on this. Michelle, everybody. Aye. So approved. All right. That gets us to the regular agenda.
1066 and 1066.
Are those quick ones?
Sorry.
Yep. Let's do 1066.
Certify nonprofit corporation low-income housing exemptions to county assessor according to the city code, Chapter 3.101.
Commissioner Nick Fish.
Mayor, this was originally on consent. We found a number of Scrivener's errors on the attachment, things like we've corrected the proper name of the corporation. We've eliminated a couple of duplications. There are no substantive changes, and I would ask that the council move an amended Exhibit A.
So move.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded. Any discussion? Carla, would you please call the vote on the substitution motion?
Saltzman?
Aye.
Fritz?
Aye.
Fish?
Aye.
Adams?
Aye.
Substitution is approved. Anyone wish to testify on the underlying resolution as substituted? Carla, can you please call the vote on item number 1066?
Saltzman?
Aye.
Fritz?
Aye.
Fish?
Aye.
Adams?
Aye.
1066 is approved. That gets us to 1068. Commissioner Fish?
Carla, could you read the ordinance?
Mm-hmm. Okay. 1068, authorize 8 subrecipient contracts totaling $2,566,155 for services in support of affordable housing and provide for payment.
Thank you, Mayor. As Carla noted, my office has also pulled this ordinance to correct another Scrivener's error. The ordinance states that we are authorizing 8 subrecipient contracts totaling $2,566,155. In fact, we are asking your support for 8 contracts totaling $2,626,155, otherwise no other substantive changes, and I would move the amendment.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded. The amendments as described by Commissioner Fish. Is there anyone that wishes to testify on this matter, on this amendment? Carla, can you please call the vote?
Saltzman?
Aye.
Fritz?
Aye.
Fish?
Aye.
Adams?
Aye.
Amendment is approved.
Can I ask a question? I was just wondering, since this was pulled, why are we giving money to Clark County Public Health?
Kate, would you come forward? And Kate Allen from the Bureau of Housing is here. She can answer that.
I guess
that.
Just in a sentence, how did you decide that these were the recipients for these grants?
These
a
are
sentence or less, if you could.
In 7 words. Thank you. This is a contract under which we receive HOPWA, Housing Opportunities for Persons with AIDS, resources from HUD. Our consortium that applies for that includes Clark County.
I see. Thank you very much.
Welcome. Thanks, Kate.
Yeah.
Any additional discussion with council or anyone that wants to testify on this matter? Carla, can you please call the vote on amended 1068?
Saltzman?
Aye.
Fritz?
Aye.
Fish?
Just a quick update to my colleagues. The Portland Housing Bureau became official on July 1st of this year. We thank you for all the support you, Mayor, and my colleagues have given us through this challenging journey. And the matters that we're voting on today are part of the routine issues that the new Bureau will be handling, some of which were previously handled by the Portland Development Commission. Aye.
Adams.
Aye.
So approved. Can you please read the title, second reading, and call the vote on item 1071?
Improve land use regulations through the Regulatory Improvement Code Amendment Package 5B. Saltzman?
Aye.
Fritz?
Well, again, thank you to the mayor for allowing my office to participate so collaboratively in the preparation of these amendments.
and also to all of the neighborhood land use chairs and all of the staff, especially Sandra Wood and Jessica Richmond, who work so hard on this project, understanding that we do a lot of visioning and the Portland plan is looking at the big picture concepts. It's these very detailed amendments which actually implement how our comprehensive plan looks in our neighborhoods. And so thanks to Tom Bizzo and my office, who also worked very hard with staff.
Adams.
Oh, I want to thank Commissioner. Did you forget somebody?
Go here, Fish. Fish.
Okay. Aye.
Adams.
I want to thank Commissioner Fritz and her staff for her involvement in this regulatory improvement code amendment package 5B. Her work with the Planning Commission is invaluable, and so I want to thank you for that, and thank you for the council for approving them. Details do matter. And thank you all for your great work. Aye. 1071 is approved. Can you please read the title for procurement report, item number 1072?
Accept bid of Moore Excavation, Inc. for the Southwest Yamhill Street from Southwest 10th Avenue to Southwest 11th Avenue sewer replacement project for $741,689.
Good morning, Council. Christine Moody, Procurement Services. You have before you the procurement report recommending a contract award to the low bidder in the amount of $741,689. The city identified six divisions of work for potential minority, women, and emerging small business subcontracting opportunities. Subcontracting participation on this project is at 100%, and work is being performed in the areas of traffic control, drilling, and boring. I will turn this back over to council if there are any questions regarding the bidding process.
Discussion from council. Is there any that wishes to testify on procurement, council item 1072? Carla, can you please, I'll entertain a motion to accept the procurement report.
So moved.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded. Carla, can you please call a vote on accepting the procurement report 1072?
Saltzman?
Aye.
Fritz?
Well, once again, we have a significant savings from the construction estimate of $1.2 million down to $741,000, so that is helpful to our budget. Aye.
Fish?
Aye.
Adams?
Aye. So approved. Can you please read the title for procurement report 1073?
Accept bid of Triad Mechanical, Inc. for the Ankeny Wastewater Pump Station Odor Treatment Equipment for $691,177.
Ms. Moody.
Christine Moody, Procurement Services. You have before you the procurement report recommending a contract award to Triad Mechanical in the amount of $691,177. The city identified nine divisions of work for potential minority, women, and emerging small business subcontracting participation. The result on this contract is 0% subcontracting. Although Triad had 0% MWSB participation at the time of bid closing, they are working with my office on carving out a portion of the HVAC work for MWSB subcontractor. As of today, they have not received all the bids for this work, so the exact contract amount at this time is unknown, but it's anticipated to be about $20,000. Dennis Carroll is from Triad is in attendance today if you have any questions of him. And I will turn this back over to council for
council discussion. Commissioner Fritz?
I'm interested that the stated reason that there's no women, minority, emerging small business subcontractors, that they didn't receive any bids. Do you have any insights on why that might be? Are the subcontracted pieces different from many of the other contracts that we've seen?
I'll ask Dennis to come up in attendance for this.
Thank you.
He's from the contractor.
Good morning.
Good morning. Dennis Carroll, representing Triad Mechanical. To answer your question, we sent out 49 solicitations to MWS firms, and we received about six total responses that we were not able to use.
And why were you not able to use them?
Well, as you know, wastewater treatment work is specialized. In this job, particularly so. It's a package system that it was a sole source approved by BES, the only one that could be used. Your typical areas that minority participation is involved in, traffic control, trucking, demolition, none of that exists on this particular project. The only ones that we were able to use was electrical, for which we received no bids, and painting, which is a proprietary coating. There's only three firms licensed in Oregon to do that coating. None of them are minorities. So that's why we have worked with the Bureau to try and take some of the work we're going to self-perform and sub that out to get some participation.
And for the electrical, is there a set list of who gets invited to bid?
No, you use the state list, and it's quite extensive on electrical, but again, on wastewater treatment, very, very small. We typically don't receive electrical bids, and that's the lion's share of a lot of your projects. O'Neill Electric is about the only one that regularly provides pricing on wastewater treatment.
And didn't bid on this one?
They did not, no.
Thank you.
So how did you arrive at the figure of $20,000 that you're going to try to find?
We looked at what's within our bid that we can sub out. Again, it's a proprietary system. BioRem is providing all equipment. We just set it in place, but there's certain parts, some transitions that have to be made, some small, the ventilation fans and ducting, that type of work.
So, I mean, we can vote on this with the assurance that there will be at least $20,000 going to MBE, or is that, I mean, you said your office is working with Triad.
My office is working. Yeah. I believe they've sent out bids and they haven't received all the bids back yet.
Right. I can assure you that we will. Obviously, you all know our company. I've done 65 projects with the city in the last 10 years, and we've got a pretty good record of making the effort and doing as much as we can.
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Entertain a motion.
Move acceptance of the purchasing report.
Is there a second? Second. It's been moved and seconded. Does anyone wish to testify on item number 1073? Carla, can you please call the vote?
Saltzman?
Aye.
Leonard?
Aye.
Fritz?
I particularly appreciate purchasing going back and your willingness to try to carve out some. And I think it shows that we still have some work to do in training companies who are going to be able to do some of this work. Aye.
Fish?
Aye.
Adams?
I also want to thank you for being willing to answer our questions here in person, and your company has done great work for us and with us, and I know you've made and succeeded in a lot of efforts around minority contracting, subcontracting, so thank you for that. Aye. 1073 is approved. Can you please read the title for purchasing or it'd be an ordinance, second reading, item number 1074.
Amend contract with Berger Abum Engineers, Inc., for additional work and compensation for the Giles Lake Pump Station Reliability Improvements, project number E08877. Saltzman?
Aye.
Leonard?
Aye.
Fritz?
Thanks to Commissioner Saltzman, Dean Marriott, and Scott Gibson for your continued diligence in protecting the rivers. Aye.
Fish?
Aye.
Adams?
Aye. 1074 is approved. Can you please read the title for emergency ordinance, item number 1075?
Authorize agreements between Forest Park Conservancy and Portland Parks and Recreation to work together to preserve and enhance the park.
Commissioner Fish.
Thank you, Mayor and colleagues. I want to welcome forward Michelle Bussard, the Executive Director of the Forest Park Conservancy, and Todd Lofgren, who is the contracts manager from the Parks Bureau. And the two agreements that are before council today are a partnership agreement and a memorandum of understanding between the Parks Bureau and the Conservancy. I'd like to recognize the good work of a number of key people in getting us to this point. From the Conservancy, Dave Garten, board chair, and Mike Wetter, a board member who many of you know from Metro. I also want to acknowledge the leadership of Assistant Parks Director Karen Loper, and Jim Blackwood from my office. As my colleagues know, a couple of months ago, following the release of the City Club report, we announced five initiatives which I directed to be completed by September of 2010. The first was to finalize a partnership agreement with the Forest Park Conservancy. The second was to deliver the final Forest Park Desired Future Conditions report. The third was to hire and assign a full-time park ranger dedicated to Forest Park. Fourth was to complete the Forest Park Recreation Survey, And fifth is recruit a City Club Forest Park Research Committee member to participate in our forthcoming budget advisory committee process. Now, Forest Park is unique. It's the city's largest natural area, and it's the largest such park of its kind in the country, with over 5,000 acres of Douglas fir, hemlock, cedar. The Forest Park Conservancy is one of 107 friends groups that help us at parks do our job. They are a tireless advocate for the park, raising funds and providing thousands of hours of volunteer labor. The truth is that we cannot manage our system without partners like the Forest Park Conservancy. And the agreement before council today defines the legal relationship between parks and the Conservancy, streamlines the development of the yearly work plan, and clarifies the roles of the organizations in ongoing advocacy efforts. As I said to a reporter yesterday, we've been dating for a long time. We decided it was time to get married. Forest Park Conservancy has many strengths. Those strengths include the capacity to raise private dollars, and I would note that they have successfully partnered with the Standard, which has made a multi-year gift in the six-figure range, in marketing and outreach. And as I drove to work today, I saw one of the signs. They've taken over the billboards throughout the city with signs that say Forest Park is at risk. Through their conservation education programs, advocacy, their volunteer coordination, and their trail work. Before welcoming Michelle, I also want to just update my colleagues that Spencer Ehrman, a key member of the City Club Forest Park Study Committee, will be joining our advisory committee, and we will complete all five action items that I set forth by September. So, Michelle, welcome, and the floor is yours.
Thank you so much. March 12, 2008, this council affirmed that the Forest Park Conservancy would be dedicated to the continued preservation, enhancement, and sustainability of Forest Park in partnership with all citizens of Greater Portland and the City of Portland. Today is an occasion to celebrate as you take up the Memorandum of Understanding and Partnership Agreement crafted as a collaborative endeavor between the Conservancy and Portland Parks and Recreation. This would not have been possible without the prescient leadership of Commissioner Fish. And today, I extend a most heartfelt thanks to you. Against the backdrop of the City Club report, Forest Park, a Call to Action, resoundingly approved on June 4th by the City Club's membership, today we also reaffirm Forest Park's importance as a regional treasure whose boundaries are gossamer filters for a flux and flow of ecological complexity, even as those same 5,000 acres provide cherished educational, recreational, contemplative, and economic values. But as Frederick Law Olmsted so astutely observed in 1903, quote, "The landscape is fine, and the possibilities for parks as far as land is concerned are excellent, but I fear the money will be deficient." There is never enough. And yet, with this hallmark agreement, which is firmly grounded in the Columbia River basalt that underlies Forest Park, we have jointly affirmed our understandings. Forest Park is at risk. It is a regional asset that we are together as a city and as a region prepared to undertake the work and secure the investments that will ensure Forest Park's long life and health. The Conservancy could not be more thrilled and honored to stand side by side with Commissioner Fish, all of you on the dais today, and Portland Parks and Recreation Director Zary Santner in inking this agreement. Just as in the early 1900s, today we have determined to think big and outside of the proverbial box, because ultimately Forest Park reminds us of our deep and irrefutable connections to wild places and to a place that, along with our ribbons of river, shapes the quality of life we so enjoy in the Greater Portland Metropolitan Region. Today, I dedicate these words and this moment to Monty Smith, who served as the Conservancy's first board president. Monty died last June after taking his own life. I know this is a moment he had imagined and would have celebrated as many as any one of his hundreds of ascents up seemingly insurmountable mountains. Thank you, Commissioner Fish, Todd, for all your work at the table, to Karen, to Jim Blackwood, to so many others that made this possible. Thank you.
Thank you. Todd, do you want anything?
I think we've covered it. We're requesting authorization for the legally binding agreement between Forest Park Conservancy and Portland Parks and Recreation. Thanks.
Is there anyone that wishes to testify on this matter? Carla, can you please call the vote on the emergency ordinance, item number 1075?
Saltzman?
Well, it's a pleasure to be able to vote on this agreement with the Forest Park Conservancy. Outstanding organization led by a poet laureate, it sounds like. I appreciated your words, Michelle. They were very magical, as is Forest Park. And Forest Park serves a lot of important purposes for the population of our city and our region, but also the wildlife of our region, too. A vital wildlife corridor between Northwest Oregon and as far down as Tryon Creek Park. So it's important. And I guess, I just want to sort of remind people that what a jewel it is, but also that it's a jewel that a lot of people who live on the east side of the city have never set foot in. And I think that's something through our employment program that we've recognized. We've exposed people on the east side to Forest Park. Hopefully they will become good citizens and support our parks in the future when they become voters. But I think it's, I've challenged Michelle on this in the past, but it's something we have to work harder on, is making sure that all residents of our city appreciate and have firsthand experience with what Forest Park is. But this is a great day. Thanks, Commissioner Fish, and please to vote aye.
Leonard.
Commissioner Fish should be justly proud of this agreement. And Michelle, thank you for your ongoing advocacy for Forest Park. And there are some of us on the east side who regularly use Forest Park. Appreciate the grandeur of it. Aye.
On your bike. On your trail bike.
Walk and run.
Don't open up that issue.
Dude, I do not use a bike in Forest Park, no.
The first exclusion we may issue may be to Commissioner Leonard. I'm good on that path. So.
Fritz?
Thank you, Commissioner Fish, for your leadership on this, and this is evidence of your commitment to the stewardship of Forest Park. And thank you, Michelle Boussard, for your leadership of what was the Friends of Forest Park and is now grown into something so amazing in the Forest Park Conservancy, and Stephen Hatfield, your stewardship director as well. And I can't think or talk about Forest Park without mentioning Sandy Diedrich, who was the founder of the No Ivy League and for many years spent half of her life in McClay Park at the Nature Center there. So Forest Park is the crown jewel of our park system and rightly needs its attention and partnership. So thank you to all the park staff who also are key to the success of this wonderful endeavor. Aye.
Fish.
As Michelle noted, in 1903, John Charles Olmsted, in his report to the city, predicted that Forest Park would be absolutely vital to the fabric of this city, this growing city, over the next century. And he was right. Today, our challenge is to maintain this gem and to be good stewards for the next 100 years. And there are a number of steps we have to take to make that a reality, and this is one of them. I just want to acknowledge the work that Jim Blackwood has done on this and a number of other projects. In the last month, we were able to successfully recruit and contract with a new operator for the IFCC. We were able to reach an understanding to move the Fields project forward in the River District. And today we bring this agreement home. And both Todd and Jim have played leadership roles on all of those, and I want to publicly thank them for their work. This negotiation took a little while, and there to get these right, you have to spend a little extra time. We hit a few bumps in the road, and at one point, Michelle invited Zeri Santner and I to her house for dinner, plied us with good food and alcohol, and lobbied us on some points. And I'm just delighted we're at this juncture and that we're able to formalize what has been a strong working relationship, but now formalize the partnership. The truth is that we cannot do it alone. Jim Blackwood and I were at the Pittick Mansion Friday night meeting with their board and seeing all the great work they've done to maintain that jewel. And Randy, as I learned, Mr. Pittick was the founder of the Portland Rose Festival. Mm-hmm. And his wife was the sponsor of the original Martha Washington Hotel. I mean, an incredible legacy that they both brought. Well, that particular gem in 1962 was at risk because of a storm and because of extensive damage, and by all rights, it could have been demolished. But because citizens stepped forward and said, we want to save it, and because citizens serving on a nonprofit board have built an endowment and are managing it, it is one of our great tourist attractions as well as one of our great resources. And so too with Forest Park. We simply do not have the resources currently to maintain all of our natural areas region-wide at the level we would like. There's over 30,000 acres. President Bragdon and I did an op-ed piece recently where we advocated for a dedicated regional funding source to manage the natural areas. But we don't have the resources. We know that. So it is critical that we have these kinds of partnerships with nonprofits and with the private sector to do our work. Michelle, thank you for your tenacity in helping to bring this day forward. I'm very encouraged about the current state of the relationship between your organization and the one I'm privileged to lead. And today we are in agreeing to, with this council action, we are moving this relationship forward to the next level. So thank you, and thanks to my colleagues. Aye.
Adams.
Well, I want to thank you, Commissioner Fritz, and your bureau and staff team. Fish, Fritz. Thank you. But I really want to thank you.
Well, she's the one in the purple jacket. Mine's blue.
Yes. I want to underscore my thanks to you and your leadership on this issue. It's tough. It's a big, wonderful asset that the city hasn't been taking good enough care of. So your efforts at these partnerships is the only way forward. And Michelle, thank you for your work in taking this organization to a whole new level of proficiency and effectiveness and visibility. It was much needed, and you clearly are smart and scrappy, and that's just and charming. That's just what the organization needs. So I'm very happy to vote aye and to continue to do everything that we can do to help this partnership succeed. Aye. All right, we are recessed till 2 p.m.
Thank you.